If you love comedy movies and Hollywood satire, you're going to want to listen to a brand new podcast called Get It to Dutch.
In Get It to Dutch, we play three aspiring screenwriters on a quest to get a script to big-time Hollywood producer Dutch Huxley.
Each week on the podcast, we perform a movie script right before your ears.
It's like going to a movie with your eyes closed.
And we have amazing guest stars, including Tim Robinson, Rob Hubel, Lily Sullivan, Jamie Moyer, and Weird Al Yankovic.
Listen to Get It to Dutch, a screenwriter's journey on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey guys, this is Paris Hilton. Trapped in Treatment is back, and this season we're taking on WASP, the Worldwide Association of Specialty Programs and Schools.
They held us in dog cages. They starved us. They beat us.
He was trying to brand us. So we were going to become the McDonald's of kid treatment.
Join my host as they unravel the story of the largest and most shocking organization in the history of the troubled teen industry. Listen to season two of Trapped in Treatment on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Scott Weinberger, journalist and former deputy sheriff. In my new podcast series, Cold Blooded, I'm embedded in the cold case investigation into the death of firefighter Billy Halpern. Experience this investigation in a truly unique way, untangling secrets that may reveal the answers to not only one case, but almost a dozen. Listen to Cold Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
They wanted my asshole smell. Everybody's smell is different. And the East Germans, the Stasi, as you know, they had a program where they would try to get you sit on a certain chair with a cushion. And in this cushion, it had special chemicals that collected your smell.
I'm John Cypher.
And I'm Jerry O'Shea.
I served in the CIA's clandestine service for 28 years, living undercover all around the world.
And in my 33 years with the CIA, I served in Africa, Asia, Europe, and the Middle East.
Although we don't usually look at it this way, we created conspiracies.
In our operations, we got people to believe things that weren't true.
Now, we're investigating the conspiracy theories we see in the news almost every day.
We'll break them down for you to determine whether they could be real or whether we're being manipulated.
Welcome to Mission Implausible.
So Adam, in our former world, when we dealt with other hostile foreign intelligence services, the rule sort of is that they can't kill us, but they can't leave us alone either. But there's a gray area in between where just how much can they fuck with us, right? Can they hurt us, damage us, discombobulate us? I don't know if you had the same thing as a journalist being manipulated, but I think it's the same sort of deal, right?
Yeah, it's kind of like our relationship. You can't kill me, but you just...
Well, that's the problem. Everything's done on Zoom now. You can't kill anybody.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, there are journalists who are killed. I don't want to belittle that. But I would say probably similar to you, every interaction, we deal with a lot of flacks, a lot of PR people, a lot of communications people, a lot of people who their job is to get a message out. And that doesn't mean it's an evil conspiracy theory, but it's, you know, I want you to see this movie, or, you know, we're really promoting this new initiative at the Department of State or whatever. And so there's, you do develop real relationships with people who are paid to manipulate you. Sometimes it does get to the hostile place. It, you know, I've had screaming fights. I've had people try and get me fired.
Break your cameras. Yeah.
Yeah. And obviously for many journalists in the world, it does cost them their lives or their safety. You know, I don't want to, but it is, I mean, I guess your job, my job, being a cop, like we're lied to, right? Professionally, that is our job. And we need those liars. We need to get information from them. And we need to somehow assess what they're talking about and what is the truth underneath it, knowing we'll never know for sure.
In our old world, there was something, you know, I don't know, better term, honor among thieves or what have you, is that intelligence services wouldn't hurt each other. You know, the worst they could do is it could kick you out of the country or something if you were caught involved in espionage. All right. So I think today we're going to talk some about this thing that's been in the news. They often call the Havana Syndrome, and it's now sort of known by a number of different names. And for those people who haven't followed it, in 2016 in Havana, Cuba, there were a number of U.S. diplomats who complained about brain injuries, headaches, nausea, migraines, and believed that something was happening to this. Maybe it was some sort of directed energy weapon. It was microwaves. It was something that they believed from the outside was being directed against U.S. embassy diplomats. And largely, there were people in the CIA station, that's our office in Havana, and there were a few Canadians as well who reported this, and it became sort of a big deal. The Trump administration kicked out a number of Cubans. Marco Rubio and others were claiming that the Cubans had attacked Americans. But then shortly thereafter, there was a number of these similar incidents around the world. And what makes it interesting and maybe makes it a conspiracy theory is just recently, the intelligence community came out with a report that said all the evidence points against involvement of any U.S. adversary involved in causing these incidents. In other words, the assumption was that somebody, and a lot of people were pointing to the Russians. In fact, I'm one of the ones who believes in this conspiracy theory that the Russians may be involved in this. Most of the folks in the intelligence community came out and said, we don't see that there's any evidence at all of a hostile power doing this. You know, I served in Moscow and I've followed this type of issue for years and years, and I still tend to think that there's something there. So what's your take on this, Jerry?
Well, there's two things, John. One is the obvious. Absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. The fact that we haven't found it yet definitively doesn't mean it's not so. And then the other thing that strikes me is the term conspiracy theory. When we throw that out, generally we mean that it's something far-fetched and not likely. This is a theory about a conspiracy. And the fact that the Russians or, you know, name your bad guy, would sit down and conspire about ways of attacking U.S. intelligence officers operating inside places like Moscow or Havana, that's not far-fetched at all. That is reality.
Let me give a little background into those people who believe that there's still something there. And to be clear here, we're friends with Mark Polymeropoulos, the guy who was one of these people who...
And others who've been...
Yes, exactly. Well, very public.
Bath and some others, yeah.
So some of the things is there's clear patterns that suggest something's going on here, and there's a long history. One of the patterns is that around the world, for largely the people who seem to have been hit by this and have ended up at Walter Reed and other places were people who worked in the CIA and often people who worked on Russia issues. They're in places where they tend to have a more of a free run in Belgrade, in Hanoi, in Cuba, in Guangzhou, China, and a number of other places. And then the history is serious. I served in Moscow, and there's decades of the Russians blasting radioactive microwaves against our embassy. A number of U.S. presidents complained to Russian Soviet leaders saying, we have to stop this. There was increased cancer seemed to be coming out from a number of our people there. A number of U.S. ambassadors died of cancer. Eventually, even the State Department put it on sort of a health warning, anybody who serves in Moscow. And there's a number of other pieces around that we'll talk about as we go forward.
The State Department needs to look into, I believe, needs to look at cancer rates inside of people who served at the embassy in Moscow over the last 20 years. I strongly suspect that instances of cancer and anomalies is going to be higher in a place like that based on things that we do know about, let alone the ones we don't. Putting carcinogenic spy dust on officers, that's clearly known. Bombarding people with microwaves, maybe not as a weapon or maybe as a weapon, and a host of other things that we've encountered in our career.
Well, that's a piece of this that's important. And those who were hit in this, supposedly by this Havana syndrome, great frustration with the State Department who runs our embassies overseas and CIA leadership that did not take these health risks seriously at first. And that fits another pattern. If you look at the people over the 1950s, 60s, and on from Moscow who are complaining about health problems from serving in Moscow, the State Department and subsequent administrations seem to just ignore or dismiss their concerns. And eventually, people in Congress pressed the administration, the new Biden administration, to help these people. And there was a law essentially passed that gave them the support they need to go to Walter Reed and other places. And to add one other piece to this, there's a contradiction here. If the intelligence community came out and said there's no evidence that this was an attack by a foreign power and said most of this seems to be just natural occurrences or pre-existing conditions, there's a contradiction in the sense that Walter Reed, the place that has studied all of these victims, have said just the opposite. The doctors have said none of these people had pre-existing conditions that fit with this brain injury, and all of them that they could find a specific marker in the brain that suggests there was a similarity between them all.
Yeah, and I think to pay the State Department its due, the agency, I think a lot of the doctors are not epidemiologists.
And that's tough because the medical professionals in the bureaucracies, they come and go. And so this studying of longer term issues is almost something just institutionally doesn't happen in these bureaucracies.
Right. I wonder if this was done and the outcomes were not good, would people still want to take your families to places like Moscow if you knew that statistically you have a higher incidence of cancer? We do take our families to places that are just unhealthy on a basis. For example, I lived in Delhi, and as judged by particulate matter, shit in the air, quite literally, because they burn cow dung during the wintertime, it is the highest rate of pollution in the world. I remember when we first went to Zimbabwe, the guy who I took the house over from was telling me about the back garden. And I've got three small girls, 10, 7, and 6. And he says, yeah, watch out for the cobras. I'm like, huh?
I was in Moscow, if you remember, when the tanks surrounded the Russian parliament and started shooting at it in the 1993 when there was a coup attempt. And I was there, and there was people shooting out of buildings and these other kind of stuff. And I remember my mother and my family being all nervous. And not long after that, they actually came to visit me and stayed in my apartment. And I remember at the end of the, you know, my mother was there, I can't even remember, a week or something. And she goes, you know, I was focusing what you see on TV and thinking about all these bigger issues. But now that I've been here, I realize I'm much more scared of you dying in this awful traffic, the way people drive here. So, I said, absolutely. It's crazy and dangerous.
So not trying to one-up you, but one-upping you. In Manila, our house was just the other side of this highway. We had this like 15-foot concrete fence. And there was an explosion next door. The neighbor had the wall blown in, and it turned out there was a bus. Someone, the Abu Sayyaf, had put an artillery shell and rigged it up with a timer and put it on a bus. It had exploded. It had killed 7 or 8 people. When the bus blew up and the artillery shell blew through our next door neighbor's wall. And for a while there, there was a question like, oh my gosh, was this possibly an attack focused on me? And the Philippine police later came in and said, oh, no, 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 it wasn't focused on you. It was just a regular bombing, right? It wasn't a bombing focused on you. And the only reason that the fence was blown in was because they put the artillery shell in facing, in the back of the bus, facing towards the front of the bus, so it would kill everybody. But somehow somebody had pushed the shell so that it went sideways and shot actually outwards and hit our neighbor's fence.
We got to take a break now, and we'll be back in just a minute.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher. I'm so excited to tell you about the brand new series of The Girlfriends. In season one, we told you about the murder of Gail Katz at the hands of my ex-boyfriend, Bob. At one point, a woman's torso washed up on Staten Island and was misidentified as Gail. She spent 9 years in Gail's grave, and then she just disappeared.
It's almost like it's become this moral obligation to find her.
And that's what we're going to do. Find this missing girlfriend and tell her story. With the help of some of your favorite girlfriends from season one, like my producer, Anna.
Oh my God.
My friend, Dr. Mindy Shapiro.
Hi, it's Dr. Shapiro, and I'd like to speak with the deputy medical examiner.
And of course, Gail's sister, Elaine Katz.
Having no closure, it kills you.
Join us as we try to solve a 35-year-old cold case. It's not going to be easy, but it's going to be one hell of a ride.
What?
I can't believe this.
Listen to season two of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, everyone. I'm Mark.
I'm Greg.
I'm Brendan.
And this is a trailer for a new podcast called Get It to Dutch, A Screenwriter's Journey.
It's about screenwriting.
And a journey. The three of us play aspiring screenwriters on a quest to get a hit Hollywood script to famous producer Dutch Huxley.
Well, I would say one of us is aspiring and the other two are sort of struggling.
Which one of us is aspiring?
No, well, they're going to have to listen to the podcast.
But I don't know, and I made the podcast.
Well, I made the podcast, and I think you guys were along for the ride.
Each week, we bring in a script, we read it, and then we give each other notes.
And you'll also hear about our adventures navigating the Hollywood system.
The show features amazing guests like Tim Robinson, Lily Sullivan, Weird Al Yankovic, and Rob Hubel.
And like any great blockbuster, it's filled with heartbreak, adventure, suspense, and just a little tasteful nudity.
And some distasteful nudity.
Oh, yeah. Sorry about that, guys.
Listen to Get It to Dutch, A Screenwriter's Journey on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey guys, this is Paris Hilton. Trapped in Treatment is back, and this season we're taking on WASP.
They held us in dog cages. They starved us. They beat us. They burned us and subject us to really horrible, cruel and unusual punishment.
After my personal experience at Provo Canyon School, I was shocked to learn that a man named Robert Litchfield, a man who got his start at the school that I went to, would go on to create a multi-million dollar empire.
He was trying to brand us, so we were going to become the McDonald's of kid treatment.
The Worldwide Association of Specialty Programs and Schools.
They prey on, you know, a parent's really natural and beautiful love for their children in a really, really, unfortunately, effective way.
At this time in my life now, if someone presented this program to me, and not just because I've already experienced it, sham, scam, beware.
Listen to season 2 of Trapped in Treatment on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
And we're back.
Right after it happened in 2016, I wrote an article about this to try to put some of it in context to show about how these kind of things that happened in the past, it's rare that we've seen in places where diplomats and CIA officers live, attacks that are meant just to harm diplomats and CIA officers. Rather, we've seen unhealthy and dangerous efforts to use technology that does hurt us, but it's often for surveillance purposes or some other intelligence purpose. So when we talked about microwaves bashing against the U.S. Embassy for years, that was most likely an effort that they would use to turn on and turn off and trigger listening devices. Back in the 50s, they would even put radioactive little spikes in people's tires that would leave marks on the road so their surveillance cars could hold back and still follow where American diplomats would go. Years ago, we sort of found out that the Russians are using this thing they called METKA, which was we called spy dust, which was an invisible electromagnetic powder that had a customized chemical identifier. And the idea was they would smear it onto door handles or furniture of cars of people like me, Americans that they suspected might be handling spies, CIA officers. And what it was a tagging agent, and it was used by the Russian security elements to covertly monitor their own community. Then what they would do is in the weekend, they would go through the embassy, and they had a means of looking for this chemical identifier through people's offices. So they would go into Ivan's office and they would see my chemical tag in Ivan's office. And if Ivan had not reported that he'd been meeting me, he would come under counterintelligence scrutiny as possibly a spy working with. And we found out eventually that this was carcinogenic and it was so unhealthy to those of us who got it. And so when I was in my first tour overseas in Helsinki, Finland, I was developing a relationship with a Russian KGB officer who eventually became one of Putin's closest advisors and became the Minister of Defense in Russia, KGB officer. And he put this chemical tag on me. And the reason we knew about it is we knew that they did this. And so we had a means of wiping and testing after a Russian had been at our house and then sending that to our science experts to test that to see if you had been spy dusted. And I had been. And I was like, oh, great. So I got this carcinogenic stuff all over my house. And that was sort of the notion that when we saw this Havana syndrome is this is odd and people are getting hurt, but is this to hurt people or is it for some other purpose?
This reminds me of a story where the East Germans did get, and I'm trying to think this on the radio whether I can even say this.
this is not a radio, Jerry. You're a little bit.
All right. They wanted my asshole smell. Everybody's smell is different. And the East Germans, the Stasi, as you know, they had a program where when you crossed over into East Germany, they would try to get you sit on a certain chair with a cushion. And in this cushion, it had special chemicals that collected your smell. And after you left, they would go out and they would take this chemically treated cushion and they would take a piece of it and they would put it in a jar. And then later, with specially trained dogs, they would go into rooms or to see whether or not you had been there or not. Now, John, I did want to ask, in reading about Havana syndrome, one of the theories that I read was that perhaps that it wasn't meant so much as a weapon, because it was mostly like in hotel rooms, but was a way to like disrupt sleep patterns. Because what people don't always know is so much of what we do in the espionage world is you've got to be quick and awake and with it and able to make hard decisions and remember things. And if they can disrupt your sleep patterns, and if they can make you not be on top of your game, if they can make you stupid, you're going to make mistakes. You know, you are an expert in SDRs, and maybe you can explain to what people is. If you can't remember license plates well or people, you're going to make a mistake and you're going to get caught. That was one theory put forward that I thought was interesting, and I'd like to get your take on that.
That's a good point. So in our parlance, an SDR is a surveillance detection run. So when we meet a source, a spy who's working for the United States, the goal is to keep that person safe, right? So that person is providing potentially life-saving information to the United States government in committing treason against his or her own country. So if you're in Moscow and you're meeting a source, you have to know 100% certainty that the bad guys did not see this. We have to be right 100% of the time. If they're right one time and they bring the dogs, like Jerry said, behind us to see where we're going, and they can figure out who was there, that Russian who we're meeting, that person is going to be arrested at the very best or executed at the worst, and perhaps even their family. So we go through, depending on the country you're in, a very sophisticated means of proving that you don't have surveillance. So you might go out, you might drive around places that you can manipulate to see if someone is following you or not, you know, from overhead traffic copters or planes of people walking or cars that are following you, all those type of things. And so one of the things I think that might speak against this being done is to try to think about the practical operational difficulties in pulling this off. You'd have to have exquisite intelligence. You have to know exactly where these people are. You'd have to understand travel patterns, where they live, what house, where their windows face. If this is a weapon that is like a directed energy weapon, you'd have to have a means to get this into the country, set up, have a means to do this so that you do not get caught. We're really fortunate here because our next guest is John Lee Anderson. He's a biographer, an author, an investigative reporter, a staff writer for The New Yorker, who's lived in war zones all around the world, in Afghanistan, Iraq, spent lots of time in Cuba, has written a number of books, and worked with our colleague, Adam Davidson. So we're lucky to have him here, John Lee Anderson.
Hey, John.
John, I've read your reporting, and I have been impressed with the reporting on a lot of places in the world, but can you tell me a little bit about yourself and how you ended up reporting on this story?
So I began reporting on the Havana Syndrome when actually Adam Entus, who was a recent hire at The New Yorker, came to me and asked me for help. The editor had assigned him to do the story, but he didn't know Cuba. So we began working together and did a story on Havana Syndrome together. Adam kept his ear to the ground and did a few follow-ups. And then we did a podcast series that took place over a year, which was great fun. And we traveled together to various places. Ultimately, I think digging as deep as anybody did into this phenomena. Prior to Adam coming to me on this, I had begun to do some investigation of my own with the Americans I knew who were dealing with the Cubans at the time, and was coming away with some interesting information that was inconclusive, but suggested that there were patterns to it that led back to the intelligence agencies in both countries. So it was a really good fit for me to work with Adam on this.
So John Lee, it's really great to have you on with us today. Your reporting on this has been spectacular. Obviously, you did a podcast with Adam Entus, and you've done several articles for The New Yorker and other things. I just wanted to start with sort of a big question. Based on all of your research into what was once called the Havana Syndrome and how the U.S. government has responded to it and to the people who believe they were hit and doctors and things, what are some big takeaways that you have? Any surprises or anything that you could guess sort of going forward on this issue?
In a way, I don't know that I've ever felt particularly surprised because, I mean, I've known Cuba over the years, going back to the very early 90s when I lived there, and then have returned over the years, sort of watching the political alchemy of the place evolve. And when the Raul Castro, Barack Obama opening happened, I was there a lot. And you need to be there to feel the street and know what the subtext is again, la bola, as they call it, the rumor mill, which is always more than the rumor mill. It's where the actual intelligence flows on the island because there is no official story other than the kind of orthodoxy of the Communist Party. Fast forward to later in 2016, when we now know that the first alleged attacks occurred, these attacks took place within a couple of weeks of Fidel dying. You know, this major historic event, for all the fact that he'd been off the main stage for a decade, this was huge in an island where he had dominated everything for half a century. And when I pieced this together, I thought, well, it makes sense. I mean, I knew that in Washington, people who were part of the opening that had taken place that there was a freeze after Obama's visit, but nobody wanted to talk about it publicly because, of course, they were being deterministic. They wanted the policy to go forward. Those who'd helped open the door sure didn't want to close it or leak that there were difficulties, but I knew privately that there were. And there was a new era of hostility. So I immediately assumed that these attacks, these events that had affected initially CIA officers on the island had to do with a homegrown attempt to shut down the station, you know, to affect America's intelligence gathering ability on the island. Now, I didn't know how they would have done that. It was out of character for them to hurt, physically damage, cause pain and that kind of thing to spies on the island. It wasn't their modus operandi. And so I assumed it was some kind of untested listening device gone bad. The more I talked with people that sort of know that world, the more I assumed it was something like a new technology that they had gotten from somebody. And the obvious partner in that regard would be the Russians. And that this might have been an easy way to go about getting rid of that enhanced American intelligence gathering presence on the island. I also entertained the possibility that it was Chinese. I'd heard that there was a lot of Chinese electronics on the island in a particular building under the purview of Cuban counterintelligence. But going back 5 years, Xi wasn't as hostile as he is today. And most people tended to dismiss it when I trotted that one out. So it kind of devolved into this idea that Russian technology in cahoots with a small group of Cuban counterintelligence with probably a very senior person in charge of the operation aimed at dismantling America's intelligence gathering ability. And they did it. And then my reading has always been that once they did it, they took it on the road. No surprise about the idea that Cuban hardliners would have done something like that. Someone told me, I think, that 2 million Americans visited the island within, I think it was 18 months or maybe it was even a year of the opening of relations. That's a lot of Americans to suddenly be swarming around Cuba. And knowing those guys and women the way I do, I would say that that probably really freaked them out. And with Fidel's death coming right on the heels of a very unexpected outcome in the American election, counterintelligence would have been in a very paranoid state and wanting to reassert control of an island where they had always known what was going on. And now they no longer did. They felt like their grip on knowledge of who was there and what they were up to, I think, was slipping away.
Let's take a breather and back in a moment.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher. I'm so excited to tell you about the brand new series of The Girlfriends. In season one, we told you about the murder of Gail Katz at the hands of my ex-boyfriend, Bob. At one point, a woman's torso washed up on Staten Island and was misidentified as Gail. She spent 9 years in Gail's grave, and then she just disappeared.
It's almost like it's become this moral obligation to find her.
And that's what we're going to do. Find this missing girlfriend and tell her story. With the help of some of your favorite girlfriends from season one, like my producer, Anna.
Oh my God.
My friend, Dr. Mindy Shapiro.
Hi, it's Dr. Shapiro, and I'd like to speak with the deputy medical examiner.
And of course, Gail's sister, Elaine Katz.
Having no closure, it kills you.
Join us as we try to solve a 35-year-old cold case. It's not going to be easy, but it's going to be one hell of a ride.
What?
I can't believe this.
Listen to season two of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, everyone. I'm Mark.
I'm Greg.
I'm Brendan.
And this is a trailer for a new podcast called Get It to Dutch, A Screenwriter's Journey.
It's about screenwriting.
And a journey. The three of us play aspiring screenwriters on a quest to get a hit Hollywood script to famous producer Dutch Huxley.
Well, I would say one of us is aspiring and the other two are sort of struggling.
Which one of us is aspiring?
Well, they're going to have to listen to the podcast.
But I don't know, and I made the podcast.
Well, I made the podcast, and I think you guys were along for the ride.
Each week, we bring in a script, we read it, and then we give each other notes.
And you'll also hear about our adventures navigating the Hollywood system.
The show features amazing guests like Tim Robinson, Lily Sullivan, Weird Al Yankovic, and Rob Hubel.
And like any great blockbuster, it's filled with heartbreak, adventure, suspense, and just a little tasteful nudity.
And some distasteful nudity.
Oh, yeah. Sorry about that, guys.
Listen to Get It to Dutch, A Screenwriter's Journey on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey guys, this is Paris Hilton. Trapped in Treatment is back, and this season we're taking on WASP.
They held us in dog cages. They starved us. They beat us. They burned us and subject us to really horrible, cruel and unusual punishment.
After my personal experience at Provo Canyon School, I was shocked to learn that a man named Robert Litchfield, a man who got his start at the school that I went to, would go on to create a multi-million dollar empire.
He was trying to brand us, so we were going to become the McDonald's of kid treatment.
The Worldwide Association of Specialty Programs and Schools.
They prey on, you know, a parent's really natural and beautiful love for their children in a really, really, unfortunately, effective way.
At this time in my life now, if someone presented this program to me, and not just because I've already experienced it, sham, scam, beware.
Listen to season 2 of Trapped in Treatment on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
And we're back.
Yeah, John Lee, I share your instinct that there is a conspiracy and that there's a Russian-Cuban link that we haven't come across yet. One thing that unsettles me, though, is that the GRU especially, they've generally been sloppy. By and large, when they get involved in these things, they get caught. And there's things like travel patterns. They talk out of school. There's, you know, we sort of get a sense of what's going on in the Kremlin. Whispers. I'm not hearing those kind of things from people who follow it. So I'm just surprised that the Russians, if this is it, that they've gotten away with it for so long.
What haven't the Russians gotten away with, however sloppy they've
thank you.
Everywhere in the world?
Well, I mean, they do it, know. They get caught, but they still just fucking do it. Yeah, I mean.
Well, you know, I say probably Russian technology because I don't know that the Cubans have it. But, you know, the Cubans have been pretty resourceful over the years in adapting to circumstances in, they have a great science nucleus and, you know, they're into scientific research. I don't know what they've done in weapons research, but, you know, they have 50 years of investment in various sectors. The only country prior to this that we know regularly used some form of microwave technology to bombard the Americans in Moscow without apparent harm, but nonetheless bombard the embassy in the hopes of either deflecting or thwarting the CIA station's, you know, abilities to listen from the embassy, I gather. It's true that we don't have a smoking gun. It's true that we haven't found a couple of characters who going around poisoning people's tea or putting radioactive toxins on doorknobs and things. But if it's asymmetrical warfare, something Putin has done a lot of, maybe this was something they tried there and took it elsewhere. It's interesting to note, although the CIA, of course, has never been, it's always been mum on this. As far as I understand, the next big station was Vienna, which is an important station. And to my knowledge, it was virtually atomized in similar attacks. And there's been no whistleblower on that. You know, the CIA has, of course, been hermetic about that. You don't show weakness to the enemy, right? I get that. And I'm not surprised either of the fact that the intelligence community across the board decided to shelve this and did so differently than all the previous lawsuits brought by soldiers or whoever affected by, you know, American weaponry in war, whether it was Agent Orange or Gulf War Syndrome. The U.S. government always shelves these lawsuits. The people who make these lawsuits, whether they're State Department, other government personnel or soldiers, former soldiers, always lose their lawsuits. I noted that in this case, they didn't lose their lawsuit. Those who claimed to have had injuries were paid compensation. And then the agencies expressed themselves in a very Solomonic way of saying, we feel your pain, but this is over. It's also interesting to note that, as far as I know, all such alleged attacks or complaints of them seem to have stopped since the Ukraine invasion occurred. Whether that's pure coincidence or not, I don't know.
It seems to me that the early investigations by CIA, FBI, and state were really, really poorly done. And it wasn't even until at some point the doctors who were looking at these people were sort of trumping and going back to the agency and saying, oh, there's nothing here. It's all fake. And the doctors are coming back saying, absolutely not. We see markers. We see that concussion-like symptoms when there wasn't a concussion and all these type of things, which of course then led, as you mentioned, to the payouts and that kind of thing. So in your investigating, what sense did you get from that? Because my understanding is now the Hill is taking this on and the Defense Department now seems to be doing investigating that seems more serious than those of the FBI, the agency, and State Department.
In talking to the medical professionals who investigated this, they were incensed. I'm thinking of one in particular, the University of Pennsylvania, was incensed at the idea that this was somehow adolescent schoolgirls getting hysterical together, which is essentially what the naysayers are suggesting.
My personal sense was, in the beginning and at the beginning of the Trump administration, especially without a smoking gun, no one wanted to take bad news about the Russians to that Oval Office that was, in my view, thought well of Vladimir Putin and said so. He came out and said he believes Vladimir Putin over his own intelligence agencies. And without a smoking gun, walking into the Oval Office and saying, the Russians / the Cubans are committing an act of war, arguably, against the United States. And there was some reluctance to aggressively go after this without absolute proof. And of course, absolute proof, unless we get a walk-in, a defector who walks in and says, okay, here's what happened. You know, we're stuck with conjecture and assessments and gut feels and circumstantial evidence. And those can be pretty compelling, but are not decisive always.
That was my sense of it, too. The ball was effectively dropped during the Trump administration. It's notable that the first episodes begin during his period of president-elect, and it becomes public knowledge in the summer of 2017. He's 6-8 months in office. It coincides with the Russia investigation and the various behavior we saw from Trump. And the episodes appear to have traveled on from Cuba over the next couple of years to various places. Even if we dismiss some of them, there's no good explanation for Vienna Station and a few others around the world. I mean, if I was Putin and I was doing it, I'd go to town because Trump isn't going to do anything about it. And then it was really the Biden administration where it's resuscitated and becomes a public thing.
I think Bolton taking it seriously when he was his short tenure there.
Yes, Bolton did. And we had a conversation with Bolton in which he basically said, well, I didn't really want to get the boss mad by bringing up Russia. He didn't go so far as to say that he had deep sixed the topic. He continued to investigate, but that he didn't bring it to Trump.
But you have an analytic cadre who's been burned over the years in Iraq and WMD and things that almost needs to have like absolute proof. And you have a White House, any White House, frankly, but this White House probably too, that says, if you're going to give me information that suggests that the Russians are at war with us, they're hurting American diplomats, and that we have to respond, you better be damn sure that it's 100% sure. And so you probably got internal battles. I can imagine the analyst saying, yeah, you're coming at me with a lot of patterns, a lot of possible information. But until we know for sure, there's no way we as an organization are going to the White House with this. And there's probably a lot of frustration inside on from our side of the house saying, for Christ's sake, we're the ones suffering this. We see Russians and GRU people in specific places. The places where it looks like this happened were places like Havana, Vienna, Belgrade, Hanoi, China, places where the Russians can operate and sort of hide themselves pretty quickly afterwards.
You know, one of the patterns that I found very interesting, and I guess it began with Vice President Kamala Harris's trip to Hanoi, there began to be a pattern in which people right next to a principal figure were zapped. That, to me, this idea of leaving a signature, that to me makes me think of only one leader in the world who likes to leave signatures.
Yeah.
Again, I can't prove it, but you know, 2 days before she gets to Hanoi, two employees of the U.S. Embassy are evacuated with apparent symptoms of Havana syndrome.
I think it happened in India too.
Director Burns goes to New Delhi. The person with him is affected. Bolton goes to London. Two of his briefers are affected, and so on. Well, Blinken goes to Bogota, and a few days before he gets there, I think 3 days before, an unnamed number of people at the embassy are withdrawn or treated. It's a bit like once they went to town, once they went on the road with this, it was this idea of, we're just reminding you we're doing this, and it's right next to you in each case. And that seems to me more than coincidental because of the number of senior officials who had people directly within their posse affected.
John Lee, thank you very much for coming and talking with us today. I really enjoyed it.
Guys, how was John Lee Anderson?
Adam, have you been hiding behind the scenes? Have you been here the whole time listening to this?
No, I'm just showing up, but you talked to one of my favorite, literally one of my very favorite people in the world, John Lee Anderson.
I think he's a fascinating guy. I know you worked with him some as a journalist, and you know, he's the kind of guy that you sort of look up to as a journalist. He's lived around the world. He's dug into deep places. He's personally courageous and been a lot of dangerous places.
I think John Lee is the single most respected foreign correspondent in the U.S. He saved my life. And I think there's a lot of journalists who can say the exact same thing. I mean, he goes to incredibly dangerous places, but he does it thoughtfully.
Also, when you think about Cuba itself, there's very few people who have the expertise in Cuba that he has. He's lived there for a long time. He's got the contacts. And so if we're looking to talk to experts, hard to find a better one.
So Churchill famously said that Russia, right, it's a riddle wrapped in a mystery inside an enigma. And I think we've only just started with the mystery, and we need to get into the enigma part of it later.
I think that's right. So today, I think we got a really good sense of the context, but there clearly is a lot more to this story. So in our next episode, we are going to continue looking at this with someone who is even more closely associated with this, someone who is actually impacted by what we're now calling the Havana Syndrome. So stay with us for the next episode of Mission Implausible.
Mission Implausible is produced by Adam Davidson, Jerry O'Shea, John Cipher, and Jonathan Stern. The associate producers are Rachel Harner and David Solinger. This has been a production of Honorable Mention and Abominable Pictures for iHeartMedia.
If you love comedy, movies, and Hollywood satire, you're going to want to listen to a brand new podcast called Get It to Dutch.
In Get It to Dutch, we play three aspiring screenwriters on a quest to get a script to big-time Hollywood producer Dutch Huxley.
Each week on the podcast, we perform a movie script right before your ears.
It's like going to a movie with your eyes closed.
And we have amazing guest stars, including Tim Robinson, Rob Hubel, Lily Sullivan, Jamie Moyer, and Weird Al Yankovic.
Listen to Get It to Dutch, a screenwriter's journey on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey guys, this is Paris Hilton. Trapped in Treatment is back, and this season we're taking on WASP, the Worldwide Association of Specialty Programs and Schools.
They held us in dog cages. They starved us. They beat us.
He was trying to brand us. So we were going to become the McDonald's of kid treatment.
Join my host as they unravel the story of the largest and most shocking organization in the history of the troubled teen industry. Listen to season 2 of Trapped in Treatment on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Scott Weinberger, journalist and former deputy sheriff. In my new podcast series, Cold-Blooded, I'm embedded in the cold case investigation into the death of firefighter Billy Halpern. Experience this investigation in a truly unique way, untangling secrets that may reveal the answers to not only one case, but almost a dozen. Listen to Cold-Blooded, the Apollo Gym Murders on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.